TV.
The reformer Saudi Crown Prince is at it again. He's admitted the worst-kept secret, saying Saudi Arabia recognizes Israel's right to exist while ignoring Israeli atrocities, even the recent carnage of protesters in Gaza. Mohammed bin Salman says he still holds on to a pre-1967-based two-state solution without acknowledging illegal Israeli settlements sprinkled throughout Palestinian territories, which make any such initiative unviable, and the planned U.S. embassy move from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem al-Quds. Is all of this to justify public relations with Israel to counter Iran at the cost of Palestinians? Join me, Waqar Rizvi, as we discuss to answer that tonight. Let's firstly go to our correspondent in Ramallah. Press TV's correspondent Mona Kandil is joining us live now. Mona, tell us a bit about Palestinian reactions to Mohammed bin Salman's statement.
Well, it seems that the Palestinian Authority didn't comment on the statements of the Crown Prince, the Saudi Crown Prince. However, Palestinian resistance factions, including Hamas and the Jihad movement, denounced the statements made by this Saudi Crown Prince, who considered the existence of the Zionist entity as legitimate. And according to Hamas movement, they said this backstabbed the ongoing return marches in Gaza Strip and serve the normalization of ties between the Gulf countries and Israel. Islamic Jihad officials also stressed that Saudi Arabia aims at eradicating the Palestinian and the rights of the Palestinians. As you know, Saudi Arabia and Israel still have no formal diplomatic relations, but behind the scenes, improvements in their ties have accelerated in recent years. And of course, normal Palestinians believe it's a major shift when a Saudi official, normal one, he's the crown prince, saying that Israel has a right to its land. And many experts here also believe that this affirmation is seen as could be seen as a key milestone in President Donald Trump for his vision to the region. And this would be raising new questions. Is the United States, Saudi Arabia, would be proposing maybe formal diplomatic relations with Tel Aviv very soon? We have to wait to see if the Saudi Kingdom would be going to direct relations with the Israeli occupation.
All right, Mona, as always, we appreciate your reporting for us. That was Mona Kandil, Press TV's correspondent, speaking to us live from Ramallah. Our guests for tonight's discussion are journalist and political commentator Maxine Dover, who is joining us live from New York. And we're also joined by Jacob Music, who is host of Voice of the Revolution Radio, and he is joining us live from Orlando. Thank you both for joining us. Maxine, I'm going to start with you. What do you make of Mohammed bin Salman's views on Israel?
Good evening. I think his views are a public expression of relationships that have been building for many years, perhaps even decades, and that there will be a change in the Middle East that can benefit everyone, not only those who are specific parties to it, but rather the entire region.
Jacob, what do you make of Mohammed bin Salman's views then?
Well, I don't think that, unfortunately, I would love to agree and say that I think that this development would help everyone in the region. I really do think that the Palestinians and those forces that are aligned with Iran, this is going to come at their expense. I don't think that Saudi Arabia, in its latest push to become a regional power, is necessarily expressing any sort of like for Israel. I think that very much it is based upon the realpolitik and the certain policy that the Crown Prince is pursuing, which is to gain more power for Saudi Arabia in the region. They are intervening in Lebanon, they are intervening in Yemen. Israel is another extremely strong and influential country in the region, and that will only benefit Saudi Arabia to be allied with them, because if Saudi Arabia goes a certain way, a large portion of the Arab Sunni world goes the same way, and they know that. So, and I would agree with your guest in saying this has been going on for quite some time. It was not a secret at all that, say, as far back as 1976 or so, Saudi Arabia was cooperating with Israel when Israel was planning to strike Iraq under the Ba'ath Party and to strike their weapons facilities. So this is the culmination of several decades.
Okay, so Maxine, then the question is, why now? If since even 2002, we can go back to, there was that Arab peace plan put in place or put forward by the Saudi king at that time, which called for, again, talks about pre-1967 borders, two states, et cetera, et cetera. That obviously never came to fruition. It has not come to fruition until now. But even at that time, the Arab Peace Initiative said that the Arab world would accept Israel if those two states were to exist along the pre-1967 borders. Why does Mohammed bin Salman choose this time now, do you think, Maxine, to make this statement?
Why now? It's a time for change. He is the designated leader of Saudi Arabia. Mahmoud Abbas is an aging, not very powerful leader of the Palestinian people who must be exhausted by his leadership in the solution to this crisis. There is a different attitude in the American administration, which is perhaps an attitude of reality and business. And the timing is one that reflects the conditions in the region. Syria needs to be stabilized. The people have suffered for a decade. The people are in turmoil. The Kurds are in a position of trying to unite their peoples in various borders and seeing what could be done to give some independence to the Kurdish people as a group. Why now? Now, because the opportunity exists. It is perhaps a time of change for leadership in Israel as well. Netanyahu will be facing scheduled elections within the two-year period, if not before. And it's a time when a new leader is taking new attitudes, both towards his own people, in instituting social reform, and towards the region.
Maxine, if I could stick with you on that, because, you know, I'm wondering, and I want you to clarify this, because certainly the Saudis do not get to decide on a peace plan. That should be certainly the Palestinian peoples and the Palestinian leadership that decides yay or nay on any peace plan.
And the Israelis.
But I'm saying, Maxine, that the Saudis certainly cannot force anything onto the Palestinians, can they?
I fully agree.
Okay, just wanted to get that clarification. Jacob, I want to bring you in then and ask you then, Jacob, do you agree with Maxine on that point, that this is just new leadership, this is a new way of doing things?
I guess you could say it was a new way of doing things. This de facto leader of the kingdom is pursuing a much more aggressive foreign policy, more independent from the United States, not necessarily taking orders from it. And it's very ambitious. It seeks to become the main hegemon that is in the region, that is, along with Israel, opposed to Iran. So it's going to take the steps that it needs to do that, to create a coalition that is resolute against the actions of Iran, against a Syria that is, as your guest saying, that is stabilizing, that is falling more and more under the control of the Damascus government, which has weathered this phenomenal storm that was the destructive Syrian civil war. Things finally are abating there. And also, Hezbollah, in helping Syria, is coming on the victorious side of the Syrian civil war. So that may have spooked Saudi Arabia, because if you recall, as around 2012, 2013, when it looked like the government would be overthrown in Damascus, Saudi Arabia instigated a change in the Arab League, whereas the Damascus representative was thrown out. The rebel, the Syrian Free Army, the Syrian rebel leadership was then recognized, and then when they have become sort of a non-entity, then they've gone back on that. But Syria is definitely a part of that. But Saudi Arabia wants to be a kingmaker, so to speak, and that's also a pun, because it is one of
Literally.
The last remaining absolute monarchies in the world. So it should be very worrying if this country is on the cutting edge of setting policy for a region.
And that brings to my, that brings me to my next point then, Maxine, because, you know, something that Jacob mentioned, and that is Iran. Do you think that less so about the Palestinians, this is really just about the fact that both Israel and the Saudis see Iran as an enemy, that this would then unite them regardless of what the Palestinians want?
Well, I don't think that Israel sees the Iranian people as an enemy at all. I think the difficulty is with the Iranian government's policy of stated desire to destroy Israel, not a policy that be accepted in any civilized country, and especially not in Israel. The Iranian people and the Israeli people had a long-standing and positive relationship until 1979, and that's certainly a relationship that could be reestablished. Their war is a very costly and miserable and bloody enterprise. And in a region that has so much potential, the reality of war is not something that anyone wants to see. You know, Muhtar Kent was the international chairman of the Coca-Cola company, certainly a company whose market share is significant throughout the region. And he once told me that the Middle East is like a table, and a table stands on four legs. And one leg, he said, was the market available throughout the Middle East, including Iran, including Saudi Arabia, and all of the other countries. And another leg, he said, was the propellant of finance and money. And he mentioned such places as Saudi Arabia, as Qatar. And he said the other component was labor, very readily available throughout the Middle East, in Jordan, in Egypt, among the Palestinians. And he said the fourth leg was technology and development, and that is coming out of Israel in full force. Israel's ability to influence and assist in medical technology, in agricultural technology, in all sorts of high-tech technology, from how you go from place to place using GPS waves, or how you install a heart valve in an ailing patient, is immense. Muhtar Kent is half Turkish and half American, and a fine businessman. His assessment was made about 4 or 5 years ago, and I remember it word to word. And I think it's something that, and he said, by the way, that within 15 years his thoughts would be reality. We're making progress. I hope he is right.
I do want to make a clarification, Maxine, and for our viewers' sake as well. It is well known what the Iranian government's point of view on this is. Ayatollah Khamenei has very clearly said that the Palestinian diaspora, as well as the Palestinians within their territories and the others in that territory, should all take part in a free and fair referendum to decide upon who should lead that area. It has not called for destruction of any entity at any given point in time. That's something that I know has been repeated many, many times, and that lie has now become the truth in many people's points of view. But I want to just put that clarification out there for everyone's sake. Jacob, one thing that Maxine there spoke about is, yes, possibly technological progress, etc., in Israel, and that obviously can be something that seems attractive to the Saudis as well, as this crown prince comes in to seek to, you know, to raise his country's profile. What do you make of that? Because that's certainly doesn't excuse, does it, Jacob, the occupation and illegal settlements, et cetera, et cetera?
No, but I think it's very important in understanding why this alliance is growing stronger and making its presence known in the media and in the public sphere at this time, because there are going to be probably strengthened business ties. There's already a certain class in the United States that is used to working with the Saudis, and there's another that is very used and integrated within the Jewish community in the United States and Israel, and then kind of forming that they can form this triangle rather easily. I'm sure there's a lot of profit to be made. I don't know necessarily the specifics on technology, but, you know, a lot of military hardware does pass through Israel, Saudi Arabia, United States, and a triangle, and there's a lot of profit to be made. And I must comment on your other guest's comment. I really wish that I could agree with the statement that nobody really wants war, and war's not good for anybody, but I just have to believe that fundamentally that's not true. You know, growing up in the Washington, D.C. of the United States, you know, the whole regional economy depends on these weapons contractors, depends on almost constant war, or at least constant increases in the military budget, especially at least for the United States and colonial kind of situations like the State of Israel. Military hardware and clashes and war and proxy wars, those are essential to the economy. I mean, for example, if the United States were to stop functioning as an empire, its economy would probably collapse, and there's several companies, Lockheed Martin, all of its ilk, the U.S. government, all of its ilk, Blackwater, all of its ilk, along with the United States military. If war were to cease, so many people would be out of a job. And so war is actually good for many people. It's not good for humanity. It's not good for the working class. It's not good for the Palestinian people, the Israeli people, the Iranian people, the Saudi Arabian people. But it is good for a certain group, unfortunately. And I think that's just the very sad truth.
Okay, Maxine, you know, one of the things that Mohammed bin Salman said in his in this interview with The Atlantic was that he believes in a two-state solution, still based on the 1967, pre-1967 borders, that is. But one has to wonder, though, Maxine, looking at the map right now and seeing the way that these settlements continue to zigzag through Palestinian territories, where Palestinian territories become ever smaller on a daily basis as these settlements keep going up, one really has a very hard time, Maxine, looking at that map and seeing how on earth can you create a viable Palestinian state when all of these illegal settlements keep going up. This will be a matter of each individual settlement needing to be negotiated. How on earth will that ever happen?
Why not? These towns, they are well-established towns, but they only take up about 5% of the so-called disputed territory. 5%. There is ample room, and there's enough desert for everybody. There is ample room to negotiate the swaps, the land swaps that everyone's been talking about for years and years, and make a viable two-state solution, one that will give life and joy and economic viability both to the Palestinian people and to the Israeli people.
With due respect, Maxine, I do apologize for interrupting you. Just because we're running out of time, I wanted to, if you allow me, Maxine, come in here, just on that point you made, because looking at the Israeli government right now and looking at the Israeli society moving even more right-wing, we have an Israeli cabinet which is ever more right-wing on a daily basis. Every single time there's an election, the government is ever so more right-wing. Do you think anybody has the political courage in the Israeli leadership to actually make any such swap deals?
I do. And I think that there is a basic reality in the government of Israel, despite its right or centrist or left political leanings, there is a real reality in the fact that the Israeli people would love to see its sons and daughters go to university instead of the army and make the army a choice. And there will always be a need for defense because that's the nature of the region. However, I think the reality is that if there were a full-fledged acknowledgement and some full security backing, there is full room to have two viable states exist, coexist, one next to the other, and not disturb these major towns that have been established over 40, 50 years, and they will go along living. I've been in factories in the so-called occupied territories where Palestinians, Arab Palestinians, and Israeli Jews work side by side, doing the same work, making the same salary, driving the same SUVs. The licenses are different, but the cars are the same, and the income is the same, and the way people learn to shop in the same supermarkets because they can, because everybody can afford bananas and everybody can afford cans of whatever they want. This is a way to build society.
Okay.
And
Jacob, if I could bring in Jacob, I do apologize, Maxine. Jacob, I'm wondering what your views are on that, because, you know, again, looking at the map, it's really hard to believe that the Israelis will be willing to make any such swaps. And secondly, you know, again, this goes back to the fact that we cannot ignore the occupation and the daily aggression against the Palestinians, the detentions, the demolitions of their homes, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes, absolutely. I think we need to look to history and also the present situation. What reason is there for the state of Israel and its right-leaning or right-wing government to change the status quo? I see no reason for that. I mean, every couple of years, there's more and more settlements, more and more area of what was supposed to have been a viable second state of, you know, of Palestine is taken away. Every couple of years, we have another war. Every two decades or so, the Israeli army passes the southern border of Lebanon as if it was irrelevant. Israel continues to occupy Syria's Golan Heights. Basic supplies, such as food, medicine, water, arable land, are unavailable in many of what is called the Palestinian Authority today. It sounds like a wonderful picture that your other guest is portraying, but it doesn't seem to be one that is reigning in much of what we know as Palestine. To be honest at this point, I think the two-state solution is a canard. We've gone on for so many decades with American associates and American presidents, you know, trying to barter for peace, and the Egyptian leader trying to barter for peace. At this point, I think we need to look to the fact that the current Israeli establishment, as any colonial society which has the upper hand is going to do, they're not going to give up their privileges just for what? Nothing. I mean, Israel
Jacob,
has already
shown that
it doesn't mind that. It is an existing state.
Is
not going there. It doesn't mind universal sanction. It doesn't mind the UN view that Zionism is racism. That was the official position of the UN from 1975 to 1991. It doesn't care. So I don't think there's any reason to think that Israel will give up this power and they will stop supporting the settlements and that they will stop their wars every few years and they'll stop their, you know, military-grade aggression against people throwing stones. It's just not going to change.
Okay, we're going to leave it there at that as our final word. Unfortunately, the clock has gotten the best of us, but of course, we do appreciate both of your contributions to tonight's discussion. That was Maxine Dover, journalist and political commentator, speaking to us live from New York. And we're also speaking to Jacob Music, who is the host of Voice of the Revolution Radio, and he had been speaking to us live from Orlando. And of course, viewers, we appreciate you joining us as well. Until next time, good night.